One of the first things we want to distinguish is this thing we just talked about, the difference between voiced and voiceless. So we have voicing and we have voice sounds. And you might not realize it, but B, D, and G are voice sounds. B, D, G. Okay, but if you do the M and you put your hand on your throat, or you make a V, or Z, okay, and you can feel your vocal cords vibrate. Whereas you have voiceless sounds, and again, if you do the F and the S, again, no vocal cords. And then P, T, and K also, no voicing. So that's the first major distinction. Then we saw in that other chart all those places of articulation. Those are all listed here, and they go along the top of this chart. You know, bilabial, labial, dental, alveolar, okay, and all those. From the front of the mouth to the back of the mouth. And then we have the manner of articulation. Again, how much are we restricting or stopping the airflow as it comes through? And we have stops and fricatives, nasals, laterals, affricates, and some other things, but this is a brief introduction. Okay? So, and those are listed down the side of the International Phonetic Alphabet chart. So, let's just look at a stop. So, this is a stop, the letter P. Now, how do you make a P? You put your lips together, right? Okay, so you completely stop the airflow for a stop. And some, they're also called plosives, but I'm just going to use the word stop. And P is a voiceless bilabial stop. So it's voiceless. It's a bilabial. That's a place of articulation. And how are you stopped? What are you doing to the air? You're stopping it all the way. And so the voiceless part is your vocal cords aren't vibrating. The bilabial part is you got your lips together stopping the air there. And the stop thing is you've got both your lips closed and you have your velum against the back of your throat so the air can't go anywhere. So if you try and do a P, eventually your mouth's going to fill with air and you've got to let it go because you go, all right. And so that's why it's called a stop. So, so if we were going to do a B, P and B are the same, except that B is voiced. So if we have pa, 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 ba, 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 and that b, b, again, everything stopped. Now it's a voiced bilabial stop. D, we change the place of articulation from the lips, and we change it up here, putting the tongue tip on the alveolar ridge. We have an alveolar, voiced alveolar stop. Okay, d, d. What's the voiceless one? You can do it. Make a D, but then try and blow the air out and pull your tongue down. What do you get? A T, right? Okay, you get a T. T and D are both alveolar. All right, and if we have a voiced velar sound, where now we've got the back of the tongue up against the back of the velum, g, g, g. All right, and what's the voiceless one to that? K, right. K, k, k. Anybody had phonetics back there? Or I want to sign you up, whoever you are. Okay, all right. Now, that's a voiced velar stop. All right, now it's your turn. Look at the picture and tell me what it is. Is that a D, right? It's a voiced alveolar stop. D, 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 d. Okay, what about this one? B, 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 b. This is going to sound really great on the tape. Okay, what about this one? Good, good. G, great. What about this one? Yeah, you said it. P, right. Voiceless, bilabial stop. Huh? That's a G again, right? G, voiced out, voice velar stop. D, D, okay. All right. So anyway, so that's just that's just a little bit. In order to learn the IPA, you would learn face diagrams and things for 135 sounds, or whatever. But we're just, just getting the idea of what phonetics is all about. So besides stops, which completely stop the airflow, like P and B, we can also have fricatives. So these greatly impede the air, but they don't stop it all the way. They cause a friction point and usually either get hissing sounds, you get air turbulence being produced. And so here's a couple that we have in English. We have the F, which is a voiceless labiodental fricative. Okay, and so you put your, your lower lip up to your teeth and and then if you turn your vocal cords on, you get okay, so those are voiceless labiodental fricative. It's voiceless. It's labiodental. It's not, even though you touch your lip to your teeth, you don't stop the air from going through there. And so it's a fricative because you've got that little space. And a voiced one then is the V, voiced labiodental fricative. Here we have S, alveolar, S. That one's a little bit weird because it's got some weird things going on with your tongue. It's called a groove fricative, but the voiceless alveolar fricative. All right, and then besides those kinds, stops and fricatives, we can also have nasals, where we open up their nasal passage here so we stop the air here, but we let the air go out and go through our nose. And so we get M. Now, we don't have voiceless nasals in English, but there are languages that have those. And all you do is put your lips together and blow out your nose. So there's a word, I can't remember what language it's in, so I think it's an Aztec, it's called Ahmagoma Mu Mu. And so, which means two yellow tortillas. But, you open the velic and you get the airflow redirected through the nasal cavity. And so we call these things nasals, and so we have a voiced bilabial nasal. Now, if you change the place of where you stop the air in here, you get the difference between mmm and mmm. Okay? Na 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 ma ma ma. Okay, so you get a voiced alveolar nasal. And I don't think I have a velar one up here. But the velar nasal, which we have trouble doing in English because in English it only comes at the ends of words, like in our word song, that at the end. In Munsing, you have to learn to say that at the beginning and in the middle and everywhere else because that's the most common sound in Munsing, is the ng sound. Ng, ngoot. Ngoot is a louse. Ngoose is snot. It's a great sound. Okay, so those are just some general ideas about consonants. But the opposite of consonants, where you stop the air or restrict it and do all these things to it, is to have really open sounds, and those are the vowels. And so here's some of the vowels that we have in English, and the things that you're doing with English is where is the tongue. And what are you doing with your lips? And let me just go through these, say these things for you. So this is E. You can all say it too. E, I, A, E, A, A, O, O, U, U. And Now that's whether the tongue is high in the mouth or low in the mouth or in the middle. I've used this high, mid, low, tense, and lax, and that's kind of an old way of doing it. That's not the real IPA way of doing it. I'll show you an IPA chart in a minute. But whether they're in the front of the mouth, middle of the mouth, or back of the mouth, whether the centrality, and then the shape of the lips, whether you have your lips spread or your lips round. So you can say this one, E, but then you can round your lips. E, So say e, okay, and that's some of the French vowels we get, are those front rounded vowels. And there's a symbol for that. It's a lowercase y in IPA. But, and then we have, like if we unrounded our U, our oo, and then smile. So we'll go, oo, so you keep your tongue in the same place, but you just change your lips. So those are some vowels. Oh, and then you have this one. Oh, it didn't work. Oh, well. What happened to my sound? Oh, my sound didn't go. Oh, well. Anyway, that was supposed to go. I don't know why that didn't work. Okay, now, pull out your papers. Now is your time to try and write in IPA. Does anybody need... Yeah, some. If you didn't get a sheet, go get a answer sheet. Okay, sound it out. Sound it out. How do you say this word? Boot. How would you write it using these IPA symbols? Okay, you have to think of these not as English now. Think about these in the way we just looked at them. I know I didn't give you much time on the vowels, but I only got 10 minutes. B-oot. B-oot. Okay? Should look like that. In IPA, that's boot. The oo says, you says oo, boot. Okay, what about the next one? Sees. Who wants to guess?
S-I-Z.
Very good. Sees. Okay, what about the next one? Bones. Who else wants to try it?
B-O-N-Z?
Right, bones. B-O-N-Z, bones. Okay, try this one. Photo. F-O-T-O. Okay, good. Photo. What about speak? Speak. S-P-I-K, right? Speak. Okay. What about Holly? Holly.
H-A-L-I.
Right. Good. H-A-L-I, Holly. Okay. What about alms? Alms. What does O say?
O-A.
Oh, there you go. A-L-M-Z. Alms. Alms. Okay. What about feels? Go ahead. F-I-L-Z. Good. And what about low? It's really easy. Hello, right? Okay. Okay. So that's a little bit of an idea of phonetics, and that's just with some simple English things. Well, here's a real IPA chart. Okay, so these are all the sounds, you know, that you would have to learn, all the stops and all the nasals and the trills, like is a sound, okay? All the fricatives. Now, you guys know these ones, right? You guys have studied Greek. This is a phi, and it's f. It's like you're blowing the hair out of your eyes. Both your lips together. And the beta here is a B with both your lips. Va, versus va, with your lip on your teeth. And here's the chart of vowels. So here's all the vowels. And here you had... Here's the real IPA. You have things that are close to the roof of the mouth and things that are open, and then all these things in between. Okay, so that's what you would be learning, all those symbols, all their names, how to say them, how to write them, how to hear them in a phonetics course.
Explain this chart again briefly. What is the position of tongue?
Okay, tongue up high in the front of the mouth, up high in the middle of the mouth, up high in the back of the mouth. It's the back of your tongue, okay? And then here's your tongue is down low. You have more room for your tongue to move back and forth at the top than you do at the bottom. And then these ones, everything on the left side of the line is unrounded. So here's the one I had you do, ooh and smile. Here's the symbol for that. Ooh, and instead of having rounded lips, you go ooh, ooh, with your lips spread. Okay? And here's the one I taught, you know, the E, and then round your lips. E, E, E. Okay? There was another question in the back.
I just wondered if you could do some of those central ones towards the top.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to do that. Have you heard of IPA Help? This is a free program put out by SIL. It's available to all of you who might want it. And you can download it on your computer. It's free. In fact, they've got the latest version of it is free now. You used to have to get the old version free and pay for the new version. Well, now you get the updated version for free. Now, here, let's get this out of the way. So here it is. So here's the symbols, and you can just click on them, and it'll do them.
Ba. 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 Ba.
Or you can put it between vowels.
Ba. Ba. Ba.
Or this one.
Ba. Ba.
Or this one.
Ja. Ja.
Or some of these ones that are in the Arabic languages.
Ha. Ha. Aha. Aha.
You can even do the clicks.
Ba. 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 Ba.
Or implosives.
Ba.
This one. Oh, not yeah. This one. This one. If you try and imitate a Coke bottle emptying out, that's kind of what you do to do that. Anyway, you learn all about those things. And then, let's see, where's my exit? Where's my exit door? You can do the vowels. All right, you asked for it. You hear the difference between those? If you did, you have better ears than I do.
E.
You got
E.
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 O.
Well, there they are. So you can sit and play with this all you want. You can actually make it give you tests, and it'll give them to you, and you have to click on them, you know, to hear them and do them. Yeah.
Would the same language have a lot of those similar ones?
No. Languages will use different things, but they try and make things as different as possible. Otherwise, communication gets garbled. And that's the whole reason we have consonants as vowels, because you have something that really stops the air, and the opposite of that is something that really lets the air go out. And there's all kinds of predictions you can make about languages that, you know, they'll have things really spread out around. Like if there's only three vowels in a language, the three vowels in the language will be almost 99% of the time this one, and one down here on the bottom, you know, way at the extreme spaces. So you never find a language, you know, that had all the vowels up here at the top and didn't do anything. In fact, every language in the world has an aw sound. So that's just one of those kind of things. Any other questions about phonetics? This is all I was going to do on phonetics. And this, if you want to find this, just put this into your Google browser on IPA Help. Just IPA Help. And it'll come right up with the SIL thing, and you can download it for free and have it on your computer. And so,
thank you for the resource. That's great.
What?
Thank you for the resource. That's awesome.
Yeah. Okay, so the next thing we want to talk about is phonology. So phonetics is the study of sound, the sounds of the mouth, and phonology is the study of the sound system, the system of the sounds and how the system works. And phonology looks at this sound system and tries to find the sounds that really that are significant. And this is a really hard concept for people to get, and I probably don't know if I can get you to sort. Hopefully, I can get you to just think about a little bit of it. But the reason you do phonology is to find the significant sounds of language or the phonemes, and then you do that in order to have an orthography that works and makes sense to the people. If you have a phonemic alphabet, you can teach an adult usually to read his language in a day. Because he doesn't have to learn, all he has to, because the same symbol always says the same thing. It's not like English, you know, where it changes every other word. It's pronounced differently. And so you can really teach people to read quickly if you have a good phonemic alphabet. So sounds are only significant when they contrast. And an overlapping distribution means that it occurs in the same place as you find another sound. And hopefully you'll see that in a sec. They're unpredictable. You can't predict where they're gonna occur, and they make the difference in the meaning of the word. So those are the things that we're looking for. So we're gonna look at voiceless stops in English. Okay? So I want you to put your hand in front of your mouth, and I want you to say the word pool, 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 pool. You should feel a big puff of air hitting your hands. Now I want you to say the word spool, 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 spool. It should be very reduced puff of air or none. I mean, you probably still have a little bit. Okay? So those P's are not the same. Okay? In phonetics, they're not the same. One has a big puff of air after it and the other one doesn't. That's different. That's a different thing. That's a difference between a P and an aspirated P. Okay? Well, we have pool, but we have spool. And written in phonetics, those would be different P's. Okay? So, now do the same thing with tool, 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 and stool, stool, stool. That puff of air should almost be completely gone in stool. Okay? So again, those are different, T and aspirated T. And you get tool and stool written in phonetics. Okay? And then, again, cool, cool. And school, school, same should have the same difference, aspirated K and K, and again, written something like this. Okay, now the question is this phonetic detail, okay, this is phonetic detail. We have aspirated P, T, and K, and here we have not aspirated P, T, and K. Is this phonetic detail meaningful to English speakers? Does it change the meaning of the word if you substitute, just change the P around, or the K? If you put a K over here and said school, will that change the word from school to school? Does that change the word? No. Or from stool to stool? It's just like, why are you doing that? You know, I was like, what are you doing, you know? That doesn't go there. Okay, no. So this is not significant. This distinction, even though we have it in English, do we distinguish these, you know, two kinds of P's when we write them? Or these K's or these T's? No. We just write a P, right? And it doesn't mean anything to us. So this is an insignificant, it's there, but our brain doesn't really think about it, doesn't really have any, doesn't associate it with any meaning change. Okay? So, no, this is all predictable. What's the prediction? Where do you find the aspirated stops versus the unaspirated stops? Okay, the aspirated stops are syllable initial, and the unaspirated stops are in the middle of a syllable, right? because they're part of a consonant cluster, or they occur after S or something. Okay, right? So you never get the regular, the unaspirated P, T, or K occurring at the beginning of the word. That'll always be an aspirated sound. Okay? And I know you didn't get much, chance to study this. Take my word for it. Okay. People a lot smarter than me have studied that, and that's what they say. Okay, so how many voiceless stop symbols do we need to write English? Okay, I've got 6 voiceless stops up there. Okay, here's the 6. These 6. How many do we need to write in English?
3.
3. Right. You get brownie points. Okay, we only need to write 3 because the aspiration is a predictable thing. We don't want to write stuff that's predictable. If we can predict it, then we'll just kind of have a rule that says where it is, and everybody kind of has internalized that in their heads. All right, and let's look at another language. Okay, we're going to look at voiceless stops in Hindi. Okay, so here's our P in English. We have these 2 P's. We just demonstrated that. P and aspirated P, like in spool, pool, spit, pit. Oh. But in Hindi, we also have... I got my thing in the wrong place. Oh, maybe not. We have aspirated P and P. All right. And we have words like this. We have the word pal, which means fruit. And we have the word bal, which means moment. Now, when I say that, you probably think I'm saying a B, but I'm not. Because if I said a B, that would be bal. Okay. And I could say those 3 words, pal, bal, and bal. Those are 3 different things. But they have that distinction between pal and bal. Right? At the end of the word, they have the word top and the word I lost a row of stuff. And the word, okay, the word kap means cup, and the word cup means phlegm. I don't know why it didn't come up on here. I missed something. But when you aspirate that P at the end, that's the difference between the word cup and the word phlegm. Okay, so how many P's, how are the Hindi P's different than the English P's?
They have aspiration.
Huh? They note the aspiration. The aspiration on the P makes a difference in the meaning of the word. That's something they're going to be aware of. I got in the wrong order. There they go. Okay. I'm going to have to refix that. Okay, so there's all our words. So when we look at this, these 2 sounds really only belong to 1 thing in our brain. Our brain only thinks in English about this 1 P phoneme, even though it comes out in 2 different predictable ways in the phonetics. In a trained phonetician's ear, you can hear those 2 things. But in Hindi, those things are separate phonemes, okay? Because those, when you change from PH to the aspirated P to the regular P, that changes the word. That changes the meaning of the word. So for a Hindi speaker, this distinction is significant, which means they have 2 phonemes, P and aspirated P, in Hindi. Questions? I know this is not easy, but yeah. This one, yes, that's a regular P. This is an aspirated P. P with a puff of air after it. If you just said it with an ah after, it'd just be pa, pa. And you say this one is pa, pa. And if you said it with a B, it's ba, ba. You'd train your ear. You'd learn how to hear that distinction. I know it's hard for you to hear it. It's hard for you to hear it because your brain is thinking this. Okay, and it's ignoring this distinction because it doesn't matter in English whether we have P's and aspirated P's. So our brain has just learned to ignore that. And so that's what you do when you study phonology, is you figure out, what I tell my students is you're trying to figure out the alphabet inside the mind. And the way you do that is to look at these distributions of where is this stuff and does it make significant changes in the words. And this is a whole semester-long class you just got in 10 minutes, okay? And you just kind of scratch the surface of it. And we only talked, There's a whole other thing called complementary distribution that we're not even going to talk about. That's too hard to try and... We're just talking about significance. Okay, so let's look at these. You got a line on your piece of paper down there under the that says, write the phonemes. Okay. So when you look at these three words, these three words, and these three words. Pit, bit, mit, tick, dick, nick, brick, brig, bring. How many of those sounds from this data can you tell are for sure phonemes? Write them down. Oops. There's another pen over there if you want to. I feel sorry for you. Keep passing a pen over on the table. Well, how many from all this from these nine words, how many things do you know for sure? Okay, not that you just guess, but how many things do you know for sure are phonemes? And you know for sure because you can see, oh, there's only one change here, and that changes the meaning of the word, then that means that those two things have to be significant. Okay, so, all right, I'll give it away here. You look at pit and bit. The only thing that's different between pit and bit is a P and a B. That tells you that P's got to be a phoneme and B has to be a phoneme because making that change changes the meaning of the word. So you're aware of that difference. Okay? Give me a number. How many phonemes do you know from this data?
Nine.
Right. Good. Okay? Here they are. PTK, BDG, MN, ng. Well, these are three bilabial, alveolar, velar, voiceless ones. Bilabial, alveolar, velar, voiced one. Bilabial, alveolar, velar, nasals. So those are the nine things you can tell from this data that have to be phonemes. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't more. But we're going to look at some of those, too. Okay. So now that's some... Let's try vowels. Okay, so here's some vowels. This is the word beat, bit, bet, bait, bat, bought, boat, boot, butt. How many phonemes do we know from this? What are these vowel, you know, what about these vowels? All these vowels are phonemes in English. E, I, E, A, A, O, O, U, A. That's why English is so terrible to write. We have 13, at least 13 vowel sounds in English, and we only have 5 symbols to write them, which is really terrible, okay? Now, but see, those are all minimal, what we call minimal pairs. Those are all the same. Everything starts with a B, ends with a T. The only difference is all the different vowels in there. So that tells us all those vowels, we as English speakers are aware of all those different vowel changes. Okay. So we've already talked about that. All right. Any questions on phonology? How am I doing? I'm going slow. Yeah. Oh, don't even get me started on tone. We don't have time to talk about tone. I mean, just in general, we have two kinds of tone. You have intonation, which is usually not significant in as far as words are concerned, but more in a meaning of a whole thing. Like if I said, Bob bought a car? And I said, Bob bought a car. Or I said, Bob bought a car? You know, and all those things that still have Bob bought a car in them, but my intonation says, I don't believe that. You know, or, really? Or, he did. Okay, so those kind of stuff that we mark with question marks, exclamation points, and periods and that kind of stuff. Whereas if you're in a tonal language, you have the difference between ma, 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 and ma. So those are all Mandarin sounds. Those are all words in Mandarin that mean horse, hemp, rope. I can't even remember. Anyway, five different words. And the only difference is, now you probably know, right? No, no. But the only difference is ma, 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 ma. All it is that in that tone, what we call a tone, and it, we got all kinds of tone. You got register tone and contour tone, but anyway. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just wanted to hear you say something.
Oh, okay. We didn't have tone in Munsing, which I was very happy about. Yeah. Well, you have to learn about tone. You know, really, if you really can't hear it and you can't get it, you would not want to go into a language that was a tone language. Half of the languages in the world are tone languages. But, you know, there's 6,800 or 927 or something, you know, so there's plenty to choose from in both sides. So, okay, any other phonology, phonetics, phonology questions? So our whole idea of phonology is to figure out what the system is, what are the sounds that are significant, and then you want to devise an orthography or an alphabet that is going to suit the language. Yeah.
Maybe this is like a later study, but if you were like a Bible translator and you went into the culture and you finally learned some of the words, how would you go about separating their words out and just discovering the grammar, or is that just a class?
Yeah, we're not real. Okay, we're gonna. Well, maybe we'll get a little bit of that in morphology. This is as far as we're gonna go. We're gonna get into breaking words down, which is morphology, is we're breaking words apart, and we're not gonna get into grammar because I only had an hour. so anyway, but morphology, morpheme. Do you guys know what morphemes are? Do they tell you about morphemes in Greek and stuff? Are you familiar with the term? Kinda, sort of. Okay, morphemes are the smallest meaningful parts. So whenever you can break it down, the smallest thing, and you can't break it, if you break it down any further, it loses its meaning. Okay, so the pieces that have meaning, the smallest pieces that have meaning. And the way that you find morphemes, morphemes are used to build words in languages. And you compare and contrast words that are the same or that are largely the same, and you associate the part that's the same in the word with the part in the meaning that's the same. And then the part of the word that's different, you associate that with the part and the meaning that's different. Okay? So, here we go. Good old Munsing. So this is on your handout. All right. So we have the word evek, evom, yeve, evimem, ever, evomu, and ueve. Okay, now what's the same about all these things? Or let's just look at the first two. So what's the same between evek and evom? The EVE part, right? Well, what's the same? Where's there a similar meaning over here? Leg, okay? So the part of the word that's the same is the leg part. So eve must mean leg, and the k must mean my. And om must mean your. Okay, so what part of this means leg? The eve part, right? So what means his?
The
I at the beginning, which is really weird. Okay, normally languages would put these things all in the same. You know, they either put them all at the end. Munsing had to do something weird, you know, and had to put the third person ones at the beginning and the second and third person ones there, first and second person ones at the end. But, okay, and so we have ever, okay, and the R means our inclusive, and the mem is our exclusive. Now, do you know what that means? You guys, Greek. How many of you are Greek? Have studied Greek? Well, most of you. You must have inclusive and exclusive second person in Greek, don't they? I don't know what the terminology, but if I said we are going to Disneyland, that can mean two things in English, right? That can mean we're all of us going to Disneyland, or I could be talking about me and my family, we're going to Disneyland and you're not. Okay, and that's the difference between, so if we said that in Munsing and we use the inclusive one, which is, well, it's te, but, or eat. Okay, eat means all of us are doing something, but if I said them, that's a different them, okay? Them means us and not you. So that's the exclusive. You exclude the hearer, or you include the hearer, the person you're talking to, in those second-person pronouns, or first-person pronouns. Okay, the plural, first-person plural. All right. So, here we go. Here's the eva, everywhere. And this actually gets pronounced evomu, and there's a rule that deletes this e, and the same thing here. That took a while for me to figure that out. And then these are all the possessive markers, okay? Suffixes and prefixes. Okay, so you see how we did that? All right. Now you do it. I gave you this on your thing, right? Yeah. So you got some Aztec data. So you try and figure out what means house, you know, what means my, what means your, what means his. You try and figure out what you can figure out from this little bit of data. You want to compare, yeah? On the Munsing?
Yeah, Ebe.
Mm-hmm.
That's a phoneme?
Yeah, means leg. And all these other things are phonemes too. K is a phoneme, om is a phoneme. They all are associated with meaning. Yeah. Okay, the quick and dirty way to do this, because I had them all lined up for you, is to look at this and go, oh, there's Kali, 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 Kali. Okay, so we'll draw a line down there. And here's Kali, 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 Kali. We'll draw a line down there. So what's the difference between no Kali and no Kali mess? Well, the difference, obviously, is the mess. What's the difference in the meaning? So what does mess mean? Means plural, okay. Now, what's the difference between mokali and mokali? My versus your. So how would you say your houses? Mokali mess. Oh, isn't that cool? All right. Ekali. Now, e means his, right? Third person possessive. All right, we do the same thing here. We got no and no, my, here's another no, my. Okay, the more you do, you start making hypotheses and you check them out, and you go, oh yeah, that works. And if you find something that doesn't work, then you go back and, whoops, I better go back and reanalyze something. You do this in a very circular kind of a way. So what's pelo mean?
Dog.
Okay, mo, pelo, mess. Okay, mo, okay, it all makes sense, right? All starting to see the pattern. Okay, and then we do here, same kind of thing. So if we were going to make a morpheme chart, we would have everything that occurs at the beginning. We have mo, no, mo, and e for my, your, and his. Right? Those are the only things that occur at the beginning. And those are all possessive markers. Okay? So we have this said, there's a slot here at the beginning that is a possessive marker. We have first person, second person, third person, singular. There's probably three more, at least, all the plural ones. You know, all the plural possessive ones. We don't have data for that, but that's what we would expect. We look at the end of the word, the only thing we either find is nothing, or we find mess, which is nothing meaning it's singular if there's nothing there, and mess meaning plural. All right, so that's a plural marker. And then we have the roots are in the middle. And we'll have you know, thousands of words here, you know, nouns, you know, there's just thousands of nouns. But we'll only have a few possessive markers or plural singular marker. And so when we do that, we mark them here and we just leave this blank and say, that's a root. You're going to put a noun root in there. Okay, so that's how you start figuring out how words are built. And so you guys just figured out how to analyze Aztec. Pretty cool, huh? Questions about morphology? This is really simple. Okay, this can get really complicated, but I'm just trying to introduce this whole idea and show you that it's a doable thing. Okay, when you go and you learn, it's a doable thing to go into a language and start learning and hearing and breaking things down and figuring out how it all puts together. Oh my goodness.
Blow you away.
Oh my. I don't even want to attempt that one. I don't know. You can find languages that really gets more into grammar, but you can find languages that talk about the distant past, the recent past, the immediate past, the present, and then immediate future. You know, you can end up with about seven tenses. There can be languages that would say that happened way long time ago, or that happened, you know, with a morpheme, with, you know, where we would, you know, use will or ed, you know, for past tense, you know, but they'll have seven distinctions where we only have the three. And there are other languages only have two. Munsing's kind of one of those. It really has things that are real and things that are not real. So anything in the future is not real. It hasn't happened yet. And all kinds of things where you say might, should, would have, and all that stuff, that's all marked with what they call irrealis, which is it isn't real. But all the real stuff that's happened or stuff in the past is marked with realis, some kind of a marker that says this is real, this has really happened. So you get those kind of things too. There's all kinds of different things with that. That really gets more into grammar. Any other questions before we, I think that's all I was going to do. Yeah, before we go on to Bible translation. I'm not doing too bad. I've already done an hour. Oh well. Okay. Here we go. What do you think about this translation? A dangerous toy. This toy is being made for the extreme priority of good looks. The little part which suffocates when the sharp part which gets hurt is swallowed is contained generously. Only the person who can take responsibility by itself is to play. What's wrong with that? Pretty bad, okay? That's pretty bad. If you guys haven't ever been, whoops, if you ever haven't been to English.com, yeah, it's really funny. And this is all real stuff. There's real signs in Japan of stuff, you know, where the Japanese have tried to translate stuff into English and not, you know, not had a good English speaker to go over it and make sure. Oh, is this a good translation? No. Okay. Everybody agrees. Bad translation. Okay. But, you know, when people want to understand the principles of translation, this is what you can get, is stuff like this. You know, either, you know, guys just translating this thing word for word from, or concept from concept, you know, in Japanese into English, and it doesn't work. So, we have the Bible in the written message of God, and what we're wanting to do is communicate this life-changing message into all these other languages. Well, how do we do that? What are some of the principles that guide us in doing Bible translation? Trying to go direct doesn't usually work. If you have languages that are closely related, you know, maybe you can go from one to the other without too much trouble. But when you start dealing in languages that are like Greek or Hebrew versus an Austronesian language, which is the one we worked in. You really can't. You have to be really careful. Well, the way you do that is to learn the life-giving meaning. You all should know this word, which is exegesis, right? You get to the meaning through exegesis. What is exegesis? Discovering the meaning, right? Discovering the meaning. Well, once you have the meaning, then you need to recast the meaning into this message that is so that the message you deliver is the same message over here. So the messages are the same. The words may be different. The words will be different. I mean, you're talking about, you know, Greek English or Greek Munsing or whatever. And so that's, it's really important that you do good exegesis. And these are just a few things that sort of illustrate the kinds of ideas and the kinds of problems that we run across. So if we translate something like this, they went home beating their breasts, and we're just going to leave it like that. What if in another culture, in Jewish culture, this is a sign of remorse and sorrow? Well, what if you leave it like that and you're translating for Western culture? You know, beating our breasts is, you know, the WWF or something, you know, all the, you know, He-Man kind of person. Or in the Tivoli, they would read that and go, oh, he's got tuberculosis. That's why they were beating their breasts. Or down in Mexico, meaning they're angry. Or in Papua New Guinea, you're victorious. You watch the guys play soccer out in Munsing, and when they win, they go. And that's what that means. So if you left this in our translation, would you want to communicate, we killed Jesus! All right! Wow, we're victorious! Is that what it means? No. So you've got to beware of biblical culture versus Munsing culture and find a way to make sure that you don't miscommunicate the message. And there are different ways you do that. And I'm not going to get into all those. If you want to ask questions about that, we can talk about that. And there are, within Wycliffe, okay, I'm a proponent of idiomatic meaning-based translation, which that's just me, and there are people in Wycliffe who are more not that way. But that's kind of where I've come from, just because of... Now, how many of you have heard of contextualization? Okay, contextualization is a huge thing. And really, we're learning even more and more as we study, you know, the second century Judaism and the things that are going on around there. We're really learning a lot about... We're really understanding who the Pharisees were and what their attitudes were even more than we knew before, because we're putting that in the context of when it was written and, you know, were the Pharisees good guys or bad guys, and it all depends on which book you're looking at. And, you know, because some of them view the Pharisees are the good guys. They're the guys who are being faithful, and other ones, other books, other synoptic gospels are looking at, they're the bad guys who are ruining everything. So contextualization is really important. Let me just give you an example here. This is my favorite example. Okay, we have this word knock. Okay, and there's, you know, a word in English. Knock, you can do that. You know, it's a word for that. New Guinea, there's a word for that. Okay, well, those words, you can have, you know, they're going to have different forms. But in English, the meaning of this word is to seek entrance. But in Africa, if someone knocks at the door... Only thieves knock at the door. Someone goes and bangs on the door, and they run away, and they look, and they see if anybody comes out. And if nobody's there, then they go in and steal the stuff in the house because they know nobody's home. And in Papua New Guinea, they're going, what are you doing? You know, it's just like, doesn't mean anything. So if you have this verse, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come into him and will sup with him and he with me. Now, if you leave that word knock and you're doing some kind of translation in Africa, is that what you want to communicate? Jesus is some kind of thief waiting to come into your heart and steal something? Or, okay. So, You have the meaning that can go across in all these languages, but they're going to take different forms and different words to communicate the same message. So the word knock in English works, but in Africa you come to the door and call. And in Papua New Guinea you come to the door and cough or clear your throat. And what's really cool is when you look at that verse, it says, "Behold, I stand at the door and call in Africa. Anyone who hears my voice..." Oh, there was something more going on there, wasn't there, than just knocking, because it says, "Who hears my voice?" So there was some stuff, you know, some calling going on. And coughing, we have so many funny stories about people coughing at our door. You'll be sitting at your house and you'll hear this. And you'll go, "Hello, is anybody there?" Nobody says anything. 10 minutes later, you hear, "Hello, somebody at the door? Who's there? Anybody there?" Nobody says anything. Then you hear, and you finally go to the door, and, "Oh, hey, how you doing? How long you been here?" 20 minutes, you know. But they don't respond when you call to them. And sometimes, you know, you hear a noise, and you say, "Oh, it's just a pig." And then it is someone at the door, or else you hear something, and you go to the door, and it was just a pig. You know, it's kind of interesting. So you want to translate the function or the meaning of the word in its context. Don't write the form of the words and then disregard its context. So that can be something that's maybe a foreign concept to some people, especially in America, who don't know a lot about translation. They just think word for word's the way to go. Well, there can be some problems with that when you get, especially in these other languages. The word may have many meanings. So what does the word "world" mean in this verse?
Humanity.
Okay, God so loved humanity. All right, all humans or something. Great. What about in this verse? "Do not love humanity or anything about humanity." No? Why are you laughing? It's the same word. It's the word "world," right?
Correct.
No?
More like,
so what's it mean in this verse?
Things that are passing, things that are not permanent.
Fallen things, okay. The evilness of humans or fallenness or... Okay, what about this one? "The tongue is a fire, an evilness of iniquity." Or "an all humans of iniquity." What does it mean here?
Concentration. Concentration or like large quantity
or something, a very large quantity. Okay. So we look at, you know, we look at this word in English and we've learned all these meanings for it. But if you just translate this word in some other language, are you going to try and teach them how they're all the different meanings of these words are? I mean, if you're fluent in two languages, you pretty much know that doesn't work. Well, let's give an example. So "world" doesn't have the same meaning across cultures either. And that's just within one culture. It had all those meanings. So failure to understand how words are used in the different cultures can be disastrous. So here's John 3:16, translated by an educated Ziga speaker who is trying to do his very best job of translating John 3:16. And he back-translated it, and this is what he got. "God wanted to possess the world so much that he sent his only son, so whoever was deceived by him would not perish, but would become a wandering ghost forever." And you're going, how in the world do you get that out of John 3:16? Well, let's look at Ziga culture. So this guy wasn't trying to distort Scripture. He was doing the best he could. But he was just assuming that his worldview was the worldview, was the normal worldview. And that's one thing we have a hard time learning, is that different cultures have different worldviews and it really changes things. So here, the Ziga are... zealous for land ownership. God wanted to possess the earth. Okay, God so loved the world. Relatives are often used as go-betweens. Send his only son. That part works perfect. Okay, that goes right across in that culture. That's That's great. You know, no problems with that. But tricks and scams are very common. So whoever was deceived by him, the idea was whoever was stupid enough to believe in him. Okay, but it says whosoever believe in him. But that's the way this comes across in their culture and their worldview. Whoever was deceived by him. People who die become ghosts on the earth, became a wandering ghost. And ghosts who have died horrible deaths wander the earth forever. So from a Ziga culture and worldview, this makes perfect sense, even though it sounds so weird to us. God wanted to possess the earth so much that he sent his only son, that whoever was deceived by him would not perish, but would become a wandering ghost forever.
I just came in.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that maybe worldview and culture are not all equal.
Oh, they're definitely not all equal.
Right. And maybe their worldview need to accommodate to scripture.
Okay. Well, that's a question you have to accommodate somehow, and the question is, how do you do that? Do you teach them all the stuff and all the biblical backgrounds? Do you translate all the stuff, you know, or do you translate the book and give them a book that's, when they read it, they understand it? Or do you translate a book that they have to go study and figure out because it doesn't make any sense and it's wrong? What are they going to do with a book like that? They're not going to read it. Well, there's a lot of stuff you have to struggle with. And translating is an art. Really is an art. There's no way to translate 100% of what's there and get it all. We don't get all that's in the Greek. We can't put it in English. We just can't do it. And the same is true from going to Greek to Munsinger or Greek to any of these other languages. And you have to sit there and weigh it and say, what do I put in? I don't want to distort the focus of the thing, but I want to get the majority of the message. And I put this in here. No, I didn't. Okay. But if you could translate as much as possible that, let's just pick Paul for an example. Okay, Paul wrote a book to the Galatians. That your translation of Galatians, my translation of Galatians would impact the Munsing people just the same that Paul's original book impacted the Galatians. That they would understand it as easily and it would impact them the same way as my translation would impact the Munsing. So if you can have that same impact, you have done a good job of translating God's word. All right. I didn't do too bad. Hour and 15 minutes. But questions? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, like I said, there's this balance thing, you know. It's like when we translated stuff, they have to learn some Jewish culture. I mean, you just can't do everything. The question is, how far do you have to go with that, and how hard do you make it on them versus how easy do you make? When Peter's up on the roof, on the rooftop praying, our people are looking at that and going, huh? Because, I mean, we have 400 inches of rain a year where we lived, and all the roofs are like this. And they said, what do you mean he's on the roof? What do you mean he's praying? He'll fall off. You know, it doesn't make any sense to them at all. And so when we translated that portion, we had to put, Peter was up on the flat roof, and then we put a picture of a Jewish house with a flat roof so they could see it. But, you know, there are just things like that that you have to do. And like one I didn't put in here. We were translating the section where Herodias dances before Herod. And Herod, you know, says, ask what you will, I'll give you up to half my kingdom. And she said, bring me right now the head of John the Baptist on a plate. and you ask the mincing people, say, why did Herodias want John the Head's Baptist on a plate? Or why does she want the head of John the Baptist? And they say, and they think about it, they read it, and they go, well, I guess she wanted to eat it. I mean, because on a plate, I mean, these guys are cannibals 100 years ago. I mean, that makes perfect sense to them. So, no, read it again. And they read it, and they go, you know, and you read it again, and it doesn't make any sense. And so, I mean, at some place, what do you do? You put a footnote in, you put it in your text, you know, and that's what I said, it's this art of balancing all this stuff. You can't have them misunderstanding it. You can't leave it like that and let them think she wants to eat his head. And so we put in to our translation, and there's a whole other realm of stuff we haven't even talked to, but it's the difference between implicit and explicit information. The explicit information is there in the text. The implicit information was all those Hebrew people who were getting this, or the Jews or the Greeks who were getting these things, would instantly understand these things just because of the common, but it's implicit, it's not in the text, but it's understood. They're, in their culture, they would automatically understand it. Well, so that was understood, but we had to make it, sometimes you have to make implicit information explicit in your language. And so we put in our translation, bring me right now the head of John the Baptist on a plate so I'll know he's dead. Because they just couldn't get it any other way than to put it that way. And we've had, you know, when you're talking about some of these groups where there are no Christians, or there's only a few baby Christians, and you're giving them, you know, the Word of God, sometimes you have to give them the Living Bible version first. Until you build up a body of believers and some pastors and people get some training. And this has happened a number of times, that you kind of give them a Living Bible version first so they can get it and understand it. And about 10 years later, they say, can we have a translation that's more like NIV or something, you know, that's tighter. And now we understand a lot of this stuff. And, you know, it took us 10 or 15 years to get there. But now we want something that's, you know, kind of tighter than that. And so that's happened in a number of places too. Yeah. Oh yeah, Dennis Cochran.
He talked about how they, you know, they have the locals around you when you're translating. I mean, is that through the whole process? I mean, bouncing.
Oh, definitely. In fact, the goal would be that you would be training them to hopefully become more and more adept at doing it themselves. Now, you'll never know the culture, all the nuance and everything of their language as someone who's going in as a, you know, 25, 30-year-old guy who's going to go in and learn this language. You'll never know it like a native. I mean, you may know it well, but you'll never know, you know. And one of the people you look for in your translation is the guy who's really clued into language. And you read something and he'll say, you know, that you should use this verb instead of that one. It'll sound a lot better in there. Make a lot more sense. It'll, you know, and those are the guys, you know, you just latch onto those guys who know all those little nuances of the verbs and the things that say, you know, you really don't want to say slice there. You want to say cut, or you want to say, you know, this or that or whatever. So, but yeah, you're working with local people all the time. You have to. And you don't want to, you actually want to be a facilitator more than anything. And like this project I visited this summer, they're taking all these languages that are left on New Ireland, and they're taking like the three that are most closely related. And they're working with that cluster and, you know, doing those in several different clusters. But they'll give one of the cluster, like, we'll just call them A, B, and C. Okay, they give A Mark to translate. They give B John to translate. And they give C Acts to translate. And so they're working with these guys, you know, and they're training them and they're checking their stuff. And eventually they get those done. Well, then there's this computer program that's called Adapt-It. And they, language A can take Mark and adapt it and run it through this computer program and give it to B and C. B can take J- John and give it to A and C, and you know, language C can take Acts and give it, you know, so you're only, they, each of them ends up translating a third of the New Testament, and they adapt it and share it, and they might have to still polish it a little bit, but the major work is done that way. And then they work it on this, and you've got one guy who's helping do, you know, one translator who's working with those three language groups and those three committee, you know, three groups of translators in each one. Yeah.
There's lots of the pictures with the people with the microphones, and, you know, the clipboards and stuff. What kind of research has to go on to get the phonetics and then to get, you know, like a pretty decent dictionary?
Usually when you're going into a place, depending on whether you're, a lot depends on how educated are the people you're working with, number one. So if you're working with people with some decent education, you know, you can spend a lot less time. And if you've got some common trade language or whatever, you can, you know, do some pretty cool things pretty quick. But if you're going into a place where there's really low, you know, and like in Munsing, a sixth grade education was about the best anybody got. You know, very little familiarity with English. We were using Melanesian Pidgin as a trade language. But you're spending the first 2 years basically language and culture learning and building a basic dictionary and that kind of stuff. And that's basically about a two-year process. And by that time, you know, really, you can probably, I mean, we worked on those alphabets. We did 7 alphabets in 2 weeks, which is pretty amazing. God was really helped us do that. But you can, you know, if you work with some people, you can pretty much figure out the phonemes. And if there's nothing really weird, there were a couple of languages, especially one, that says like, man, you know, here's our basic thing, but somebody's going to have to work on this a lot more because it's too complicated, you know, for us to figure out in such a short time. But in a couple of months, you usually can have a fairly decent orthography worked out. And again, that's a whole nother science of, do you use Hindi? Do you use Cyrillic? Do you use Roman? I can't remember. There's a whole bunch of languages that are going to be using non-Roman scripts that are still left to do. And they're using some basic Arabic or something, you know, modified in certain ways so that it fits. But we have a whole section of guys working on computers to work out non-Roman scripts for languages, for certain languages, and adapting some of those things to them. Yeah.
So are some of the newer languages that are being written down, are some of the people who are writing those languages down just deciding to use Arabic or other?
You know, it's really not your decision as a translator. That's really a decision of the government and the local people. You're trying to say, we need to have, you know, 24 consonants and, you know, 13 vowels. And that's kind of your contribution to that is we need this many phonemes, you know, in order for this to be an easily readable language, you know, or, you know, that the alphabet's going to fit. And then how they do that really has to do with the government and the influence of neighboring languages. And, you know, the government may say, you don't have any choice. You have to use this script. That's it. If you want to work in this country, you got to do this. And who knows? You know, that changes from country to country to country, depending on, you know, what the government is and how friendly they are or unfriendly they are or whatever. Yeah.
That made me think of another question. What's your attitude toward getting to know governmental leaders and
it's always good. The more you do, the better. Sometimes you're in a place where they actually have people. That's their job. We had people in Papua New Guinea. Their job was government relations, working with the government, talking about who is over there, SIL, who is Summative Linguistics, what do we do, what can we do for you, how do we work together, you know, what kind of visas are you going to give us, and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. And you have people there full time. But your local government, you want to get to know those local government people as well. Yeah.
Can you describe how a scripture use went for the, your people group and how it progressed to a church or a group of believers?
You mean for us for in Munsing? We actually had a few believers who had become Christians from the neighboring language group that had a translation project going on. And they had seen that and come to know the Lord. And they were going, we want that for our, for Munsing. Completely, completely unrelated language. Knock and I, next door to us. Completely unrelated. Not a word the same. Nothing. And so there were a few Christians and, we were able to train a local lady to do literacy. She became the, actually at one point she was the literacy coordinator for the province, which was pretty cool. So she was doing all the adult literacy classes. We actually had some literacy people come in and do some literacy. We had fairly high literacy rate. A lot of places you have to really work on literacy right from the start in, because if you produce a New Testament, nobody can read it. What good does it do? But we, you know, we produced a bunch of health books and story books and history, Munsing history books and all, you know, so people got used to reading and, you know, got used to reading their own language. We translated, we did the Jesus video. It was actually the Luke video, but we did it in a Jesus style. We did that, we dubbed that on and we took that all around and showed that all over, which was, that was really great. I mean, one of the, I think the people in the village, we had 25 villages and about 3,000 people in our language group. And I think one of the most fun times I ever had was, I think our the village, the Levege village, which is the village we lived in, they'd seen the Jesus video like three times. Or at least, you know, because we had it, you know, and they'd say, show it to us again, show it to us again. And anyway, this one time, they wanted to see it again, and I can't remember if we were doing some celebration or whatever, but I took two nights to show it. And I'd seen it like 50 times, you know, so I knew it backwards and forwards. And I stopped it at every scene and taught about what they had just seen, about the Jewish culture and the sacrifice and, you know, Mary going in the water and cleansing, you know, after the birth of her child. And I'd say, okay, and in this next scene, look out for this and watch this. And, you know, this is going to happen. And this is, you know, this is how they do that in Jewish culture. And that's one of the great things about Jesus is that it's so really well done in its Jewish culture. And I still get chills up and down my spine because we could hear the Hebrew going on in the background. And when Jesus is born and the shepherds come, they go running out and they're going, Yeshua, Yeshua, you know, and they're going, Messiah's here, you know, and they're talking in Hebrew and or Aramaic or something. You know, and it's just kind of still, you know, just, ooh, it was just so neat, you know, to hear it that way and hear that going on in the background while we're, you know, dubbing over the original language. But so, and that's really about what we did. Other people do other things. I mean, we did some stuff. Gospel Recordings came in and recorded some things for us with some picture story books. And so a lot of that depends on the individual language situation, what's going on there, literacy, how literate are people? Are they going to become readers or are they going to remain oral? You know, and we had a situation where people were going to be readers and even the adults learned to read and the kids were all learning to read in school. And so having printed material worked out well for us. So, well, let's mill around, have some food, and I'll hang around as long as you want to stay. Any of this stuff on the table here, feel free to take it. Some of the books, literature, whatever. I would really like to know if you're interested at all in Wycliffe or in Bible translation. I know Glenn would like to have your name on the information. Well, I'd like to have your name too. If you want to hear from me, if you want me to keep in contact with you, please give me your name and email address and phone number so that I can keep in touch with you. You know, track with you where you're going, what you're thinking, and if you're interested in Wycliffe. I'm not, Okay, I'm not so, I mean, I think Wycliffe's one of the greatest mission organizations in the world. Just because I'm so sold on what we do that we give, you know, the living double-edged sword word of God to people, and the Holy Spirit's going to take that and, you know, cut and slice and do what he needs to do in the lives of people to turn them to God. And we do it better than anybody. That's what we do. I don't think that's, you know, it is a prideful thing, I think, but it's a true thing. Wycliffe does Bible translation better than anybody. We train people, you know, and that's our thing. So if you're interested in that and but if you're interested in IMB or going with Pioneers or New Tribe, you know, I just want you on the mission field, you know, and I'm not going to say you have to join Wycliffe. Wycliffe's the only way to go. You know, if you end up going in some other mission organization, you get on the field doing Bible translation, I don't care. If you're doing Bible translation, I'm happy. If you're with Wycliffe, that's great. But probably someday, if you're doing Bible translation, someday you're going to be in an SIL school, which is run by us, because we're basically the only mission that teaches people how to do Bible translation. So, okay.
The group that organized this is called Bible Translators in Training, and.